Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, noted child activist Dr. Bob Sanborn, and policy expert Shay Everett. What do we have on tap today, Bob and Shay?
Hey, thank you so much, Don. Shay, you're in the studio.
I know, it's been a while.
Yeah, you doing okay?
I'm doing great and happy to be here.
So Mandy is off, I think she's like family vacation skiing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, snowboarding. I think she's a snowboarder, right?
Yeah, that's what they're doing.
And trying to emulate the Olympics. And are you a big snowboarder yourself, Shay?
No, I tried skiing once, but it didn't go too well. I'm not that coordinated, I don't think.
I am officially a spill master when it comes to skiing. Like, I just fall all the time. So I'm more of a beach guy.
Okay, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So, but Mandy, she loves the snowboarding.
Mm-hmm.
So, Shay Everett's here in the studio with us today. And Shay, looks like it's going to be a good show, huh?
Yes, we're starting off today's show with the Children at Risk Assistant Director of Social Measurement and Evaluation, Claire Tracy, to tell us all about the significance of the number 60.
The number 60.
What could it mean?
What could it mean? What do you think that is, right? Is that Claire's grandmother's age?
Maybe.
Yeah, that's something like that, right? After Data Head, we're going to be talking with Elizabeth Mackingvale. She's Assistant Professor over at Baylor College of Medicine. I've heard her speak before. She talks about mental health families. She specifically talks about OCD.
Obsessive compulsive disorder, yes.
Yeah. So I think they'll be interesting. OCD in kids. Mm-hmm. And, we think of this as sort of like, a disease of adults or, a mental illness for adults. But it really has a big impact on kids. So it should be interesting.
Yes, and then up next is our good friend Brian Green from the Houston Food Bank here to talk with us about SNAP, which is our food stamps program in America, and the continued Hurricane Harvey relief efforts.
We love talking to Brian. After Brian, we're going to check in. My nephew, Kevin Murray, is a student at Stoneman Douglas High School, Parkland, Florida, Shay, where all this horrible stuff happened last week. And so I talked to Kevin today, and he was talking about some of the aftermath of what's going on. And I asked him, giving him plenty of outs, asked him if he'd be on the program today. And he said, yeah, he'd be happy to come on. And one of the things that he's talked with me about is this idea that everyone's pulling together like a family. So what a horrible thing. I mean, right?
It really is.
You and I were both on TV last week talking about this. And and it's interesting, right? One of the things we immediately met as a staff, right, to talk about the shooting. We crafted some of our guiding points in terms of talking to the press. I know you and I haven't talked about this, but I feel like I've changed completely from those talking points. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's evolved. And what's been interesting is I think this time around our national conversation has evolved. And
I hope so, right?
I hope so. And it's wonderful to get kids' perspectives on it, too. I mean, not to interfere with their privacy or their grieving process, but the way these kids are coming together and standing up and having a voice right now is very admirable.
Yeah, and so it'll be interesting, I think, to talk to Kevin and see sort of the mood of the school, which is dark, but I guess pulling themselves together. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so that leads to our thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yes, we are going to talk about school walkouts to protest current gun laws. What do you think about that, Bob?
I'm ready to walk out myself, right? I love these ideas. I guess there are two dates where this is going to happen. And one of them is a 17-minute walkout, right? So to sort of commemorate the 17 kids that were killed. And I love this idea of kids sort of acting out. But, we're in Texas. And I have a feeling a lot of schools, there will be no walkouts.
I think you're right. And I think it's great to see these students doing this and to exercising their freedoms. But also, they need to go vote. If they're 18, they need to go vote.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Will they vote, you think, Shay?
I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
We'll see.
That's an interesting thing. Our final guest today will be our good buddy, Dr. Stephen Kelder. He's a professor in the Department of Epidemiology, Human Genetics, and Environmental Sciences. I need to tell him that department name is too long.
Too long.
At UT Health. And he's at the Dell Center there for healthy living. And he'll be talking with us about the impact of e-cigarettes.
Hmm.
So he recently wrote in one of our journals, one of the journals of Children at Risk, about the dangers of e-cigarettes. So you know people who smoke e-cigarettes, don't you?
Yeah, it's pretty common, I would say, especially in the South. A lot of people smoke cigarettes or e-cigarettes.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just this. I mean, visiting New York City, I saw lots of people doing this. So Very, very interesting. Last week, Shay, I don't know if I talked about this. Maybe I talked about it last week. But I did a little vacation. We went up to Port Aransas. And did I talk to you about this, about the devastation that we saw?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a big deal today. And I was at the Hurricane Harvey meeting this morning, and we talked a little bit about sort of all of that devastation. And so I'm looking forward to a couple things in this this hour, but certainly talking to Brian about food and the devastation of Hurricane Harvey. So it should be a very interesting thing. But I think it's going to be a good show.
I do, too. It sounds like a wonderful show.
And because you're in the studio, it's going to be wonderful. So, Shay, thanks for doing this. Dr. Bob here with Shay Everett. And are you ready for a little bit of Data Head?
Yes.
Very good. So Claire Tracy's with us. She is the Assistant Director of Social Measurement and Evaluation, one of our top-level researchers over at Children at Risk. Claire, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you guys?
We're doing super well. Shay is, like, taking control here, I must say, Claire. She's just all over it. Claire, have you ever been have you ever been a guest host here on the radio show?
I have not been a guest host, but that may need to change sometime soon.
Oh,
I think,
yeah.
I don't know if Claire would be good, but she would like it, right?
Sure. Bob, you're awful.
Right, Claire? Don't you think you would love doing this?
I think I'd be pretty good at it.
Yeah, I know you do. I think you'd be pretty good, too. I think you would be very good. So, Claire, what is the big number today?
It's 60.
60. Any guesses, Shay?
Maybe a percentage.
60% of something?
Yep, you're spot on.
All right, what is it?
All right, the 60 correlates to 60% of school districts in Texas, according to a study that we did in 2016. We found that 60% of school districts in Texas do not have a written school recess policy.
So do we know, does that mean, that doesn't necessarily mean, though, that schools don't have recess. It just means there's no policy on it.
Yes. So it does not mean that they don't offer recess. It just means that there's nothing written down in paper that says how that recess time is spent. And so what we often see is that because of that, they actually don't have recess, and they're taking it away for a variety of reasons.
So I have noticed in looking at some of these numbers, right, it's that districts that don't have a policy are the ones that are more likely to cancel recess, especially for schools in some of the low-income neighborhoods, right? It's just the idea of eliminating mm-hmm. recess and focusing on the test, like kids don't need exercise.
Right, yep. So the big thing is that it's more time. So they see that 30 minutes or 20 minutes, however long that school provides recess, they see that as an opportunity to have extra time to catch those kids up when they may be behind on testing or for disciplinary reasons. So say they're acting up in class, instead of giving them recess, they just make them have a timeout or detention, and they don't give them that time.
And the whole reason we're talking about all of this is because there's plenty of research out there that shows that unstructured playtime is incredible for kids' development and growth mm-hmm. and also their social skills, and also helping expend some of that energy and maybe giving the teachers a little bit of a break, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Claire, you're not too far. I mean, you're pretty young. You're one of the youngest people on the staff. What would it have been like for you as a kid if you didn't have recess every day?
Yeah, so, I mean, in my elementary school, I often didn't have, like, I had it taken away, like, a couple different times. I mean, I thought I was a pretty good kid, but, you know, from time to time, I had my, you know, I was talking too much in class, or I wasn't sitting in my chair, things like that. So, yeah, there were definite times that I remember not having it, and I was a pretty busy kid. I had quite a bit of energy, and I remember feeling that. Like, I can look back on those days, and I have a personal account of knowing, you know, that if I didn't have that time, how it impacted me throughout the rest of my day.
So you only had one recess in elementary school?
Yes, we had a 30-minute recess. It was always after lunch.
How about you, Shay? How many?
That was about the same for me, 45 minutes. But I went to a private school, so I think it was, like, kind of different.
I had two recesses. I went to a public school, two recesses, one in the morning, one in the afternoon for
elementary. Puerto Rico?
In Puerto Rico, yeah. The whole day was a recess in Puerto Rico. It was one big, fun recess. So we also didn't have drinking fountains, so we had to go buy little snow cones. This is the only way that we could.
Oh, gosh.
So you needed the recess to do that. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Yeah. You need some water.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we had to do. So, Claire, any other final thoughts on this whole idea of recess?
No, I mean, not really that much. I think we've covered the main points. I mean, I think the big thing and kind of whole reason why we're bringing this up is, you know, last session we were behind a bill, House Bill 3145, to really encourage school districts to have some sort of recess policy, not telling them what it had to say, but just saying, look, you need to have something that protects this sacred time for kids. And so now we're back. You know, the bill unfortunately didn't pass, and we've been funded to collect some data around really what is the landscape of recess in Texas schools. So we're doing this big statewide survey, collecting a lot of data, really hearing from people, you know, what their realities are and what's going on, hearing from parents how they feel about recess, if it's something that they want for their kids or if they value it. To really go in with the next session with, you know, some clear data and a really good agenda. So, yeah.
Very good. Claire Tracy is a researcher and assistant director of the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation over at Children at Risk. Claire, thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on the program today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right,
bye,
take
guys.
Care. Bye-bye. You're listening to KPFT, Pacifica Radio 90.1 here in Houston, and I'm real excited about having Dr. McInvale on the program. We have a little theme music for Dr. McInvale. We have a little bit, and today we want to talk a little bit about OCD, right? And so we have Dr. Elizabeth McInvale. She's assistant professor, Baylor College of Medicine. Elizabeth, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How are y'all?
Very good. They lost your theme music, Dr. McInvale. What's the deal with that? What would your theme music be, by the way? Do you have some?
Oh, goodness. I have no idea.
Yeah, right, right. Just put you on the spot, on the radio. So, I've heard you speak a couple of times because I've gone to all those, the School of Social Work things, right? All the fundraisers that they have. And you've been at a couple of those. And is the area of mental health and OCD, is that sort of your specialty area, Dr. McInvale?
It is exactly right, yeah. So I specialize in, you know, mental health stigma, access to care, but my main specialty in all of my clinical work and research is centered around OCD.
So tell us about OCD and children.
Yeah, so OCD is one of the leading causes of disability in the United States. It's obsessive compulsive disorder. I think, unfortunately, society and a lot of stigma and stereotypes have made OCD into something that's kind of trivialized and normalized when really it's a debilitating chronic condition. So we see anxiety disorders, right? About 1 in 4 people live with an anxiety disorder at some point in their life. OCD affects about 3% of the population, so we see it diagnosed and treated as early as 4. And it's typically onset, you know, right around adolescence and early childhood.
And how did you come to start studying this issue?
So I was diagnosed with OCD when I was 12. Grew up here in Houston, had a family that's well-known and well-connected, yet we continued to face roadblock after roadblock when it came to my treatment and getting me the help that I needed. I ended up at the Menninger Clinic, which was in Topeka, Kansas at the time. It was a residential clinic. That was 3 years later after my diagnosis when we finally found proper treatment that changed and really saved my life. And for me, it became my career and life mission to not just, you know, decrease stigma and increase access to care, but to do what I can so that people get the treatment that they need and deserve.
You know, last week after the shooting in Florida, we talked a lot. Shay and I did a lot of media around the lack of mental health in our public schools. And I know you went to a public school, and was that a big deal for you in terms of there wasn't really counseling going on in the schools?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so, I mean, typically your school counselors are really schedulers.
Right,
you know, that's
right.
What we've kind of learned in public school systems is that you get sent to the counselor to help you prep for, you know, what classes you need to take to be able to graduate, not as much of what's actually going on and your mental and emotional needs. For me, I almost had a different experience, to be honest. I grew up in Houston, went to a private school out in the Woodlands, very expensive college prep school, and they were actually really terrible with my mental health condition. Mm. They weren't willing to make accommodations. They weren't willing to understand and to help me. I had a counselor there that was actually phenomenal, but the school itself, the principal, the leadership, they weren't really into. They wanted, you know, students that were going to help raise their scores, not kids that they were going to have to make accommodations for. And so I actually got kicked out of the school because of my OCD, and I ended up over at public school at Spring ISD in Houston. And, you know, public school was actually a different experience for me. For the first time, I had teachers who, cared, who wanted to learn more, who asked if they could read books and, you know, went to the websites and learned as much as they could about OCD.
Wow.
And it was really the teachers that did that groundwork, not the counselors.
Very which, nice.
Yeah.
You know, I got lucky, but that, you know, that's not how it should be.
Yeah.
That is. And what do you think are the kind of supports that teachers need? What are the systems that need to change in order to better, whether it's identify and diagnose these for kids in school or just support them in their learning?
Both. You know, I mean, the first thing is assessment. We need to be able to know what we're even looking for and certainly what to do when we see some behavior that's concerning or needs to be addressed. You know, most teachers are overwhelmed. They don't, and they're really not given the education to be able to know what to look for and how to support the kids as needed. And so these kids fall through the cracks. You know, one of the things I struggle a lot with is why do we do, you know, drug education and sex education, but not mental health?
Mm.
Often risky sexual behaviors, often risky, you know, substance use disorders or early behaviors are secondary to a mental health condition. Yet we're only treating, you know, the symptoms later. We're not treating the problem itself. And so, you know, there's just so much to be done in terms of mental health reform in the state of Texas. We might be great at a lot of things, but we are not good at mental health.
Now, we talk about this all the time, how with recent additions in funding, we went from 49th to 49th. We just don't do a good job in the state of Texas around mental health. Talk a little bit, if you can, Elizabeth, about for parents and the do's and don'ts in terms of their kids and OCD.
Look for the signs and don't turn your eyes. You know, I think a lot of parents want to believe it's just a quirk or there's not really something wrong with my kid. Or, you know, that would mean that, you know, they're different or people are going to judge us. And the reality is that if you openly address what you see, we can take preventative measures so that it doesn't become detrimental and your child doesn't become one of those statistics where they're forever disabled by their illness. There is incredible help available for mostly all mental health conditions. And if parents would recognize the signs and symptoms and take action, I think we'd see a lot of things differently. Most people talk about the fact that, well, we tried to just, you know, fix it ourselves, or we tried to, you know, and also I'm not going to blame just parents. Practitioners are just as much, if not more, to blame. There's practitioners all over the state, all over the country. This happened to me for years where they say they can treat this illness and they tell people that, you know, oh, I can help your child get better. And they really have no idea what they're doing and they're making symptoms worse. And so it's a whole system that needs to change. But the thing I'll say, which is most important, is look for the signs. If you see disturbances in your child's sleep, in their eating, and or in their functioning, that includes social functioning, educational functioning, you know, work functioning, whatever it might be, try to figure out what's going on that's causing that disruption.
And what are some resources available to any parents that might be listening right now, whether it's around OCD or other mental health disorders?
So I run a foundation here in Houston called the Peace of Mind Foundation. You can visit our website at peaceofmind.com. We have incredible resources in terms of videos, educational content, so that you can better understand what is OCD, what are some of these related disorders, and what does treatment look like. Here in Houston, our foundation has really been able to create a network and an unbelievable kind of group of system of providers so that we can try to get anybody anywhere the help that they need. We don't have that in a lot of other cities, but we're working hard to expand that. Otherwise, if it's not OCD, it's not an anxiety disorder and you don't know where to go, we're happy to help filter that, but also use the resources available. NAMI, which is the National Alliance of Mentally Ill, Mental Health America of Greater Houston is an incredible nonprofit. I mean, we have great resources here in Houston. We just need to tap into them.
And we need more funding from the state. One last question, Elizabeth. At Children at Risk, we've been leading a coalition around recovery from Hurricane Harvey. And time and time again, the idea of mental health for traumatized kids comes up. I was at an event for Main Street Theater a couple weeks ago. Your dad was honored, Mattress Mack, and he had this passionate story about Hurricane Harvey and everything that happened. But when we look at the recovery of our children, especially those that have experienced trauma, there's a lot of work to be done here in Houston, isn't there?
There's an incredible amount of work to be done. And I think a lot of times when the floodwaters recede, right, we think the problems go away, and they don't. A lot of these problems are long-lasting. We're going to see detrimental impact, both in mental health, physical health, and certainly financial health for most Houstonians.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of resources to look at. If you go to our website, again, at peaceofmind.com, we have a mental health video for Hurricane Harvey that we did that talks just about what signs to look for in your kiddos, how to help them, what sort of treatment is recommended for trauma. And then OK to Say, which is an incredible nonprofit that really talks about coming out about mental health, is doing a panel at U of H where my dad, myself, and leading trauma experts will be leading this panel on what to look for, particularly in kids related to trauma post-Hurricane Harvey.
Elizabeth McInvale is assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine and expert on mental health. And thank you so much, Professor McInvale, for all the work that you do. And thank you so much for being on Growing Up in America today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So much to be done, right? I mean, it's and I'm not sure that we could hear enough from mental health experts and practitioners around this and mental health, right?
Mm-hmm. And her story is incredible. I mean, to be affluent and well-connected and have those issues.
And still have obstacles, right, laid in front
something.
Of you, right? So now imagine if you're in the third ward or down in Sunnyside or, you know, Gulfton, and you're having some of these issues. First of all, your parents aren't going to be able to identify it. Mm-hmm. You do need the help of those teachers, right? Right before
really
something's
going
to happen. I want to continue our theme around the hurricane, but also do some food stuff. We have our good buddy Brian Green on the line. Brian Green is the president CEO of the Houston Food Bank. And it says here, Brian, that I guess I need to sing your theme song, Jungle Boogie, right? Isn't that...
I heard you have a marvelous theme.
Jungle Boogie. So how you doing, man?
Well, life is going good. We have some interesting proposals out of Washington, and we certainly hope that some of them fail.
What did you make of that, Brian? I mean, that wasn't on my list of things to talk about, but now that you mentioned it, you know, here in the middle of the week, right, and we think life is fine, and then we get this proposal out of Washington that instead of using SNAP or food stamps, as some people call them, where those that are in low-income areas those that have food insecurity can go to the store and buy food. Now they're going to get a box of canned goods delivered to them, like Blue Apron, right? It's going to be like Blue Apron. So
except with unhealthy – or with canned goods.
With canned goods, yeah.
Well, actually, so the use of the word blue apron was a very clever marketing gimmick. In fact, the program doesn't specify that it's even delivered. It just says, the states will figure this out. So what would that be? It would be definitely dry goods, but how do they have to go somewhere to pick them up or deliver it? That's not in there, let alone the fact that it would not have anywhere near the nutritional quality. It fails on a couple of points. First off, the claim is that this will save $130 billion because USDA will be able to buy the foods with its purchasing power cheaper, which is absolute nonsense. The supermarket business is incredibly efficient. It's a low-margin business. They purchase as cheap as you possibly can. We know what they purchase at. We know what USDA purchases at, and know they're not going to be cheaper. So the savings are an illusion. In addition to that, I think where they could actually generate the savings is by providing far less value to the consumers. Instead of as providing as much dollar value that they can get fresh foods, we're going to give you half of that in the form of some cans and boxes in a box. And we're not going to worry about the cost of that because this is the sneaky part. They just basically shift all that to the states and say, the states will figure that out. So that's what they call an unfunded mandate. So it is a bit of trickery in that. I don't believe that the USDA professionals came up with this scheme. They know what they're talking about.
Yeah, we know the USDA professionals. They're pretty good, actually, right? And you and I have talked so many times, even on the air, about how great they were with hurricane recovery. It can't be them. It's someone has a harebrained idea, and other people who didn't know anything about it said, yeah, that's a good idea, right?
Or they just, forced to basically run this. The other part, of course, and I think you've already hit on that, this is a horrible disservice to the people being served, where they would get less nutrition, less ability to choose. I mean, so if they're going to put peanut butter in the boxes, well, what if that family has the kid with a peanut allergy? Any of us who with children, you know what it's like.
Yeah.
You try and get nutrition to the kids by understanding what it is that they'll eat that's nutritious, and you try and delicately find that balance versus, oh, guess what? It's going to be peas. You hate peas? Well, it's going to be peas anyway.
And even if you don't have picky kids, these are families who are likely living in food deserts. And I have a number of friends who, you know, grew up really poor, and they would, you know, go in and out of that income level for being eligible for food stamps. And they knew that they were on food stamps when they had fresh vegetables and fruit at home in their kitchen. And they knew when their mom just made it a little too much money that they weren't off of it when they were back to packaged meals and fast food. And so this is really about children and nutrition, especially these kids who are way more likely to have poor health outcomes.
Yeah. So the good news is I'm fairly confident that this is going to be just simply dead on arrival. Congress is struggling these days, but they're not struggling that much that they would actually pass something like this.
Well, we still need to give our friends at USDA a hard time about this, though, Brian. I think they
well,
deserve
again,
it.
I don't think this is their fault. I bet you they're every bit as embarrassed about this as I am. This is a proposal.
Hey,
there are some other things that you know in the president's budget.
Yeah, go ahead.
Proposal that you know pretty scary stuff. So you're looking at reductions in the earned income tax credit, and child tax credit, TANF, temporary assistance to needy families. This is kind of, this is what used to be called welfare. So the hardest of the hard cases. Now after all the welfare reform that we've done in the 90s, you know, these are the people who really need it. That's the only ones who are left on there, and they're looking at pretty significant cuts in TANF. All the money that we receive for nutrition education to try and help improve eating habits and help people have more nutritious lifestyle, even though they're trying to live on a budget, all of that money gets cut. The community development block grant money gets cut. There are going to be a huge amount of cuts to programs that directly impact children. And what I'm afraid of is some of these are going to slip through because there's so many assaults on programs designed to help kids that are in this budget that, yeah, something's going to fall through, and it's going to have consequences.
Brian, there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of fighting ahead, a lot of defending of children in terms of food insecurity. I wanted to ask you, you and I continue to lead this coalition in terms of the recovery of our children from Harvey. When you look at food insecurity in our area, and I know that you and your team at the food bank have been working really hard to ensure that those that are hungry have plenty of food and families and children are fed during this time, but it's not something that's ended, right? You're still finding that there's a lot of work to be done in regards to food.
Yeah, and it's actually, it reveals part of the weakness in the charitable system that people don't like to talk about when they say, well, you know, the churches will step up. Churches are tired.
Mm-hmm.
This is the biggest thing we're fighting right now is there are still tens of thousands of households that are very much in recovery mode where they have significantly elevated expenses. They can't get by. We're trying to get resources to them. But we've had so many partners that basically just said, you know what, we're done. we're just tired. We want to go on to other things. And for these households, they can't go on to other things. So, yeah, we're trying. We've got a lot of people that really deserve, you know, heroes, accolades. But it is, I think, falling short for these households that kind of weren't the most, I guess, photogenic of the victims. They say, okay, you were really hurting for a few days, and then we helped you, and you're fine now. And people love those stories. They don't like the stories of the household that is still struggling, even though months have gone by.
Brian, how can our listeners help with this? Are there any parts of town specifically that you need more partners in? Can they ask their churches to step up, or any?
You know, that's a very good question, Jay. Thank you very much for asking that. Absolutely, they can. So don't even worry about which part of town. If they'll call us, call the food bank, 713-223-3700, and say, you know, I heard that you guys are kind of lacking in some partners who are willing to continue to do disaster relief work, you know, distribution, because we've got food that we managed to get donated and funds to do it. And we're still in an elevated level of distribution. We're almost at 50% above normal, but we want to be over 50% of normal through June at least. And you say, you know, maybe we would, maybe my church would be able to, you know, and have a conversation with us and we'll figure that out.
Brian Green is the head of the Houston Food Bank and one of the top people in the fight against poverty in our area. Brian, thank you so much for all that you do, and thanks, as always, for being a guest on the show and being a great friend of Growing Up in America. When's the last time you were on, though? It seems like it's been a while, huh, Brian?
I know. I think I must have done something wrong so you guys won't let me. You know, I think what it is, though, is I just don't have your singing voice, Bob.
Yeah, that's it.
That's why
you don't let me on. That is it. Well, you know, we need to give you some singing lessons and bring you back on the program. So
I would appreciate that.
There, Brian Green, Houston Food Bank. Thanks, Brian. We'll talk to you soon, man.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT, Pacifica Radio. And with me is Dr. Bob, along with Shay Everett. Shay, how you doing?
Good. This is fun. And yeah. I feel like Brian, too. I thought that, like, y'all iced me or did something wrong here because I hadn't been on the
you
show
You hadn't been
in
on
months.
For a while?
Yeah.
Months. Yeah, very good. Hey, Shay, last Wednesday, you and I were busy at work. And I think you and I were in a meeting together and we got a little notification that there was a shooting at a school in Florida. And you and I both went on TV, talked about this a little bit. And unbeknownst to us, this ended up being this horrific, horrific event, right, in Florida at Stoneman Douglas High School. And also unbeknownst to me, I had completely forgotten my nephew goes to school at Stoneman Douglas. And I talked to him earlier today and asked him if he'd come on the program, and he said, sure. Kevin, how you doing, man?
I'm good.
Very good. And Kevin, one of the things in talking with you, and I know you were just talking to Uncle Bob last time we did this, but talking with you, and you're talking about how everyone at the school was feeling right now. Talk a little bit about some of the feelings that you're seeing, and you talked a little bit about the sort of the family feeling you're getting right now?
Yeah. Everyone is, pretty much everyone at the school is upset and is very emotional right now. And it's good to have everyone coming together and acting like a family for each other and being here for each other to help get through this.
And you were at the vigil the other night as well?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that, Kevin. How was that?
It was very emotional. They had family members and people come up and speak about what happened and talk about gun control, and everyone was there. And it was a very emotional thing that happened, very touching.
And when you see, you know, one of the things that I think the rest of the country is seeing, Kevin, is that seeing these young, you know, your classmates sort of speak out and talk about guns and talk about, you know, being in this dangerous situation. And you're seeing just, you're just seeing the immediate, but for us, we're seeing all these kids sort of speaking out for the first time. It's sort of invigorating for us. I mean, do you guys get that everyone else is sort of applauding what you guys are doing right now?
Yeah, I've gotten that a couple times from other people.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting thing. During the day of the event, I know a good friend of yours, Ashley, she was shot, and she's alive, but she was shot in the leg, and she's in the hospital. You spent a lot of time at her bedside. How's she doing?
She's doing really well. She's taking it very good. She doesn't really seem like it hit her. She's very happy, like very, and she's staying very positive about it, and she's doing really good.
And you guys, you're like in the percussion section together of the marching band, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I know that you're good buddies with her. Shay, you had a question for Kevin?
Yeah, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. Is there anything that you would like to say or that our listeners should know that maybe isn't being shown on TV or that they may have not read about? Just anything you'd like to share with them?
Yes. I know the police department and FBI has there was multiple calls about the shooter, and they kind of ignored it. So if you were to see something that happened or see something where someone is troubled and needs help, please contact the police. And the police, please go and investigate and not ignore it so something like this won't happen again.
Yeah, wow. And, Kevin, when you guys go back to school, and when do you guys get to go back to school, Kevin? Do you know?
They are saying next Monday.
Mm-hmm.
No one's really sure yet.
Yeah, and you will have gone to some funerals by then. Have you been to some of the funerals?
No, not yet. I am going to one.
Yeah, what do you think it'll be like to go back to school after having that traumatic event?
It'll be very different. Everyone would just be in shock. I know I would. I know they are taking down the building, or they're going to, and going to put up a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very good. You know, no one has to walk down those halls again after that experience. So that'll help.
That is good. And, you know, I just want to say again, thank you for coming on the show. I know it can be really hard to talk about it. And so many people, even I'm a millennial, and many millennials haven't even gone to funerals yet or mm-hmm. hadn't had grandparents yeah. pass away yet. And
right.
when you do, it's so hard on you, and particularly at this young age. So thank you. And, you know, our thoughts are with you.
Kevin, you're a junior. And another thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about is you talked about how every day when you'd be dropped off, Coach Feist would be there, Aaron Feist, with a big smile on his face greeting you, and he was a good friend to a lot of students, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, and what are people, people talking about him because, you know, of him saving so many kids?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of posts online, and a lot of people have been talking about him. And it's a very sad thing that happened. And his funeral is going to take place over 2 days because so many people are going to be there.
Wow.
So they have to expand it out.
How are your parents and the parents of some of your friends dealing with all this? Because sometimes parents act very different than we do, right?
Yeah. My parents, they've been kind of on edge about things,
mm-hmm.
Making sure I'm safe about, you know, everywhere I go, wanting me to check in, a lot more. Same with all the other parents of my friends. They're also more on edge about things.
Just being protective, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Kevin Murray is my nephew, and he goes to Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the program, and say hi to your mom and dad for me, and we'll talk to you real soon. Okay, Kev?
Okay. Thank
All right.
you.
Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kevin.
You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT Pacifica Radio. You know, I feel almost bad, right? But he wanted to talk, and so...
Yeah, and I think sometimes that's a way for students to grieve or feel heard.
Yeah.
Is by being... I mean, and you talked to his mom. I think you went
right.
through all the right things
yeah, yeah.
to see.
His mom and his dad. And a good question, Shay, because, you know, you think these are your typical teenage nephews or nieces, right, who just usually have one-word answers. And I talked to his mom earlier today. She said, he only has one-word answers for me, but maybe he'll open up to his Uncle Bob. But for you to ask, does he have anything else to say? And he did. That was really good. So
yeah,
thanks so much for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have even thumbs up, thumbs down music today? Let's go with the thumbs up, thumbs down. You ready to do a little bit?
Oh yeah.
Boom. So thumbs up, thumbs down, Shay.
So our topic today, we It is time for our social conscious scale. Feel free to call in to weigh in on the issue. 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT. So what we're talking about today is on the hashtags National School Walkout and hashtag April 20th Walkout to plan mass boycotts on the anniversary of Columbine High School shooting.
So should kids walk out or not, right?
Basically.
But these shooting, and what are the dates for these walkouts?
March 14th, which is being hosted by the Women's March, and it'll last for 17 minutes to honor the 17 victims of the Parkland, Florida shooting.
So you just walk out for 17 minutes starting at 10 in the morning.
Yes, and yep. Then that's the only one that we have information on here, but I thought that the other one was...
There's another one, too, April 20th walkout.
Well, it must be April 20th, yeah.
Yeah, so April 20th, there's also going to be one. That's the anniversary of Columbine,
mm-hmm.
right?
I can't believe it's been 20 years.
Yeah, I can't believe it either. Sort of an odd little thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? Should kids be walking out?
I think so. I think it's never too early to exercise your voice and to have an opinion on something as big as this, even if, you know, you have an opinion when you're 16, and I'm sure when you're 26 or 56, those opinions change. But still, this is what America is about.
Yeah.
And it should be. And I don't think we do these things often enough, even as adults. And so being able to really empower these students and give them this platform is great. But I think what would be even better is if they walked out and all went and registered to vote, those who could.
Yeah.
Because you are not going to change laws until you elect politicians who will change the law.
So I love this idea. I'm big thumbs up, two big thumbs up on kids walking out. I mean, the 17-minute walk, and I don't know how long the Columbine walk, but I love the idea of if kids sort of get their blood going around activism and speaking up for this. You know, if they truly believe this, I don't want them walking out. I talked to a teacher recently. She said, well, they're going to walk out and they're going to go to Burger King, you know, and maybe, right? Maybe if I walked out, I might walk over to Burger King, but I don't want people to walk out because they want to go for someplace else. I want them to walk out because they truly believe in this, and I'm all for it. Now, what's going to happen though, Shay? I mean, you went to school in Huntsville. What's going to happen at a high school in Huntsville? Are kids going to walk out for this?
I don't think so. I think the more, you know, rural and gun loving you get, then the less you'll have walkouts.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid to see counter walkouts, right, who are like, well, we want our assault rifles, so we'll see what happens.
Well, and that indeed may happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. So big thumbs up from you, big thumbs up from me.
Thumbs up from me with the caveat of they need to vote.
Vote.
Yeah.
Register to vote.
Action along with this.
Yeah. So we're going to take one phone call, and then we'll move on to Steve Kelder. But our first with Tag, our good buddy Tag. Tag, how you doing, man?
Great, thank you, despite all the problems.
Yeah.
I have a thumbs up. I think the great kids have been doing a great job at expressing, you know, the angst that they're feeling. And
yeah.
I just wanted to throw out this one idea.
Sure.
If we're not going to get any change of the gun laws, or if the gun NRA is going to continue to do this type of thing and deteriorate the fabric of our society like they are, maybe we need to build a memorial on the Washington Mall, you know, similar to Vietnam or something else, another memorial, and start putting kids' names up there just so they don't forget.
Wow.
Not a bad idea.
And part of it's the shock value of that, just that very idea, right? These are kids that didn't have to go to war. These are kids that were just going to school. But because our country refused to act on any public policy that could maybe save their lives, we've had to do a memorial for them. It's probably cheaper than doing anything else, right?
Well, and not only that, but it would be saying we aren't going to forget these children that have been subject to somebody's pressure to destabilize your society, which I'm not going to mention any names, Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
So who said that? So Putin, oh, wait a minute. I didn't say that. Goodbye, guys. Have a good day. Thanks.
All right, take care,
Thank
Tag.
You.
Bye-bye. So some big thumbs up. And I'm going to walk out. Are you going to walk out? We'll walk out of our office, Shay, at the same time. What does it mean when, like, the boss walks out? I guess everyone feels like, yeah, we get 17 free minutes, right?
Well, I think that we're an office full of very active people. So
yeah.
I think we would walk out as well.
Very good. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT Pacifica Radio. Up next, we want to talk a little bit about this whole idea of e-cigarettes and vaping. And so we brought on the guy who we know knows more than anyone else about this, Dr. Stephen Kelder. He's a professor at the Department of Epidemiology. Epidemiology. I'm going to get that one of these days.
One day.
Human genetics and environmental sciences. Dr. Kelder, how you doing, Steve?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
Very good. So Shay and I were super excited to talk to you about this. We had a big conversation about e-cigarettes. And are e-cigarettes safe for you, Steve?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about, Bob. I think they're reasonably safe for me, but I'm 60 years old. And
So for children.
Are they safe? They have nicotine in them. Nicotine's an addictive substance. And I wouldn't want anyone to be addicted to nicotine myself.
What about vaping around children?
Well, you know, there's a couple things to think about with regard to vaping with kids. And first of all, nicotine, we've got nicotine receptors all over our brain. That's one of the reasons that it is so addicting. And, you know, when you take a puff on something that has nicotine in it, whether it be a cigarette or a vape stick or a vape pen or whatever, you're going to activate those nicotinic receptors, and then that will activate the dopamine and reward pleasure parts of your brain. And that's why it's addictive. The problem with kids is, one, they sort of underestimate the harmful consequences of anything, right? So there's a development that's going on that makes them less able to understand risk, let's say. And nicotine really is a risk. I will say that vaping is probably... Not probably. It is less harmful than regular combustible tobacco smoke, but children's brains are still forming, and adding nicotine into that mix is a bad idea.
And probably the same goes for pregnant women.
Absolutely, for pregnant women. You know, we've known for a long time that moms that smoke while the baby's on board, there's a whole long list of harmful consequences, including stillbirth, impulse control disorders, mood disorders, some delayed developmental speech and hearing patterns. So you don't want to smoke when you're pregnant. And the culprit with all those problems I just mentioned is the nicotine. So it's nicotine that's problematic for pregnant ladies. Yeah.
And I mean, there is a little bit of research coming out, but not near as much research as around, you know, cigarettes themselves. Is there a need for greater research around this?
Oh, my God, yes. There's definitely a need for research. And, you know, I just mentioned, I admitted to you, I'm 60 years old. So I was born in 1958. And the first Surgeon General report that sort of gathered all the information about cigarettes came out in 1964.
Hmm.
So my mom didn't know the dangers of smoking when I was born, and my older siblings too. So yeah, we need lots of research. And you know, first we thought smoking just caused cancer. Then later we learned that it caused heart disease and stroke. And then we learned it caused lots more cancer than just lung cancer. So the research is just accumulating on tobacco. So we know a lot for combustibles, cigarettes, but there's a whole lot more to know about e-cigarettes, yeah.
Because there's still a lot of chemicals in those, right?
There are. So, you know, when you think about what's in the e-juice that people smoke or vaporize,
the e-juice,
it's propylene glycol, it's nicotine, and it's a flavoring substance. And sometimes there's vegetable oil added, too, to make it smooth. So those are the chemicals, and they get heated up in a chamber. They don't combust, though. So that's the reason why they're less harmful than regular cigarettes is when you burn something, the molecules rearrange and they can turn into harmful things. So, but even when you heat up the e-juice, there's still a chance that you will emit some toxins. And that's why they're considered less harmful but not safe.
Hey, Steve, and there's no the vaping and e-cigarettes is the same thing, right? I mean, for people who don't know.
Yeah, that's true. There's a number of different devices out there, which are commonly called e-cigarettes, electronic nicotine delivery systems. You might hear them that way. That's the formal phrase. But you know, early on, about 10 years ago, they had little things that they called cigalikes, and they looked just like a cigarette. They were small.
Yeah.
And then they got a little bit bigger. And then they added larger tanks to them and disposables, and then there were cartridges. And now there's for the aficionado, there's you might see people puffing on these bigger devices.
Yeah.
And you can go to the vape shop and get your own liquid and mix your own flavors and whatever amount of nicotine that you want. So, but it's all vaping and smoking. But I will say one thing, a new word that's out in the last couple of years is called juuling. There's an e-cigarette device called the Juul, J-U-U-L, and it looks just like a thumb drive or a little memory stick.
Yeah.
In fact, you can plug it into your computer to recharge it.
Wow.
And I've been hearing reports all over the country. That's by far the most popular one amongst high school kids and young adults.
Oh, man.
And just to make this clear, though, you know, if you're a parent and your child, you hear, I want to do this, it's safer, it's not like cigarettes. And I've heard adults say, oh, no, this is safer than cigarettes. You're the researcher and you're saying, This should be just like if we were parents and we wouldn't allow our kids to smoke. You're saying don't allow them to do e-cigarettes.
Absolutely. You know, I've got a 16-year-old. He's surrounded by Juuls at school, and he gets lots of offers to do it. But no, once you're addicted to nicotine, it's very hard to quit. And the research now that's accumulating is saying that if you start smoking and using nicotine and become addicted, and there's always a likelihood of that when you expose yourself or smoke in nicotine, that you'll graduate to regular cigarettes, and we're right back to where we started from, you know, 20 years ago when 50% of the kids, actually 30 years ago,
yeah,
50% of kids were regular smokers, and it still is the leading cause of death.
Yeah.
So we want to get rid of cigarettes because they're just so bad for you. And adding nicotine into the mix, I don't think is a good idea.
And are there states that do a better job? Are there policies that have been developed around e-cigarettes and vaping and the Juuls that we might identify that as sort of good public policies to implement? Or
there's a variety of different policies to choose from. You know, our state in 2015, I believe, added e-cigarettes to tobacco in terms of sale.
Yeah.
At 18, and it issued a guidance for schools to have them not be on campus. So, you know, I talked to a principal just the other day, so he's found just in the last couple of years, a 10 or 15-fold increase in the amount of devices he's finding on campus.
Wow.
So they're getting in there. So we have regulations on the books in this state, in Texas, and in most other states for age 18 and possibly 19 in other states. You know, one of the things that concerns me in particular with the Juul is that it has the highest nicotine content that I've ever seen in any of the devices.
Wow.
So here we've got the majority of kids, the most popular product, the Juul, being used by kids. And it's chock full of nicotine, and you know, possibly it has more nicotine than a regular cigarette does.
And this is pretty.
So that makes it highly addicting. And
yeah.
So we could issue regulations to reduce the amount of nicotine in these things. I know the EU allows only 20 milligrams per deciliter, and that Juul has 59 milligrams
per deciliter. Holy cow! Wow.
20 in England is considered a very high dose of nicotine.
Wow.
And that's why all these kids have Juul, right? They're sort of addicted to it, right?
Well, they could become addicted, yes.
Yeah.
I'm worried. I'm definitely worried. Even if he does puff and blow it out, you'll get the nicotine in your mouth and in the early part of your lungs. And, you know, it will get absorbed. So, yeah, I'm worried about that.
And these are happening at one of the worst times in a person's life in terms of developmental stages. When you have teenagers, it's one of the worst times to be doing having cigarettes or drugs or alcohol, because it can really damage the brain and continued developmental growth that's supposed to be occurring.
Well, that's true. I mean, we think about normal and healthy growth and development. So, you know, any of those substances, alcohol, nicotine, or other drugs taken earlier in life than necessary, the younger you take them, the more problems you have. So you go down a path of more problematic behavioral decisions. So nicotine's addictive. You start using alcohol in earlier age. You make bad decisions. And, you know, the more high you get early on, the less likely there are to learn other things that you need to cope and
mm-hmm.
live life and develop healthy relationships with kids. So it's a bad idea all
wow.
the way around and to be avoided. I will say, though, you know, and your listeners might be saying to yourself, you know, I used to smoke and I used to drink. Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, I did in high school, too, which was in the 70s. But, you know, some of these consequences are modest in terms of your brain growth and development and sometimes not well perceived, but they're still measurable. And it's why would you want to, you know, reduce any firepower you've got in your brain than God gave you?
I think that's right. That's right. You ready for our final four with Steve, Shay?
Absolutely. On to a more fun note now.
These are our final four at 54. We just want to learn a little bit more about you, Steve. So what's question number one, Shay?
Well, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid, Steve?
My favorite toy. You know,
Cigarettes? Were they little play cigarettes, Steve? Is that what they were?
They had a lot of candy cigarettes around when I was a kid. There were plenty of real cigarettes in my household when I was growing up.
Yeah,
I hated cigarettes because that smoke was everywhere up in Illinois in the winters. But I had a toy tank that I used to drive remote control.
Oh, very good.
I used to love that little tank.
And well, that's fun. And what was your favorite book to read as a child?
You know, I love to read. So I remember reading a lot of science fiction and Robert A. Heinlein, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Stranger in a Strange Land. I remember that being a favorite book.
Oh, man. I loved Robert Heinlein. Science fiction, a little science fiction. What did you want to be when you were growing up, Steve?
You know, I certainly never thought about being an epidemiologist. But when I was a kid, I don't think my parents still know an epidemiologist is. They think I'm a skin doctor or something.
You could just tell them it's some science fiction nonsense.
Right. No, my first, I guess when I was a kid, I just wanted to be a business guy and make money.
A business guy.
I grew up in a modest community where there wasn't a whole lot left over. And I just didn't have lofty goals, that's for sure. I just want to be gainfully employed.
Gainfully. What, Shay, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I remember when we did like our second grade, you know, career day thing, I wanted to be the president.
Oh, you did?
Of the United States. Sure.
There's still a chance, Shay. There's still a chance.
It is.
That's very smart of her, Steve. I wanted to be a pirate, so it's very different. Very different.
You look like a pirate.
I know, right? Arr. So final question for the day, Steve. What was your favorite TV show growing up?
Oh, wow. There's a lot of them. I guess that's either Lost in Space or Laugh-In.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
I know. You remember those. Or maybe Maxwell Smart. Get Smart.
Yeah. Wow. Those are all good shows.
He was
shows.
Ahead of his time with the shoe phone.
So I watched all those shows in Spanish, right? They were all dubbed into Spanish in Puerto Rico. So I remember watching those shows. Steve Kelder is out at UT Health and one of our great health experts in the state of Texas. Steve, thank you so much for all the work that you do, and we'll see you next time on Growing Up in America.
Thank you much. Bob, can I have one last thing to say?
Quickly, very quickly, 10 seconds.
Very quickly, if you're interested in schools, look up in Google Catch My Breath. There is a free program available for your school.
Oh, excellent.
Look it up,
yeah.
And you'll get it, and you can inform your parents and team.
Catch My Breath. All right, Steve, take care, man.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Shay, you've done a great job today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We need
you.
To have you back more often, right?
It's been fun.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of activism in the wind right now, right? A lot of people acting out in terms of hurricane recovery, activism against these guns that we've seen so much horrendous use of. A lot of work to be done. But listen, I want to thank you, Shay. I want to thank our producers. We will see you next time on Growing Up in America here on Pacifica Radio.
Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD3 stream. New and improved, get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not, nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming, created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD3. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT Houston. Hello, folks. This is Don from KPFT. Just letting you guys know that for the next hour, well, actually, for the next 30 minutes, you all have a little bit of ups and downs. Sometimes you won't be able to hear the actual radio show. Just stick with us, because you already know that this show is worth sticking with. So, folks, just know that if it's going in and out, it's not you, it's us. You're just getting some stuff together. A little bit of spring cleaning, if you will, in a end of winter.